Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 21st, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Roberta Bondi. Session number is 98-2 and is titled Sayings from the Desert, Love. Let's listen in.
I'm out of here.
Okay, I'm Roberta Bondi, and this session will be on...
Start the tape.
Well, I don't know how it started.
No, you say it. Haven't they told you?
I'm supposed to say. Okay, start the tape. this session will be on the notion of love in the early monastic literature, which was a central concept to what they were about. Before I start saying anything, though, I'd like to find out how many people were not here yesterday. Oh, goodness. Oh, goodness. Well, let me see if I can, in 5 minutes, say something about who these folks were that we're looking at. In the 4th century, really the beginning of the 3rd century, I mean in the middle of the 3rd century, a group of folk in Egypt decided that, or felt called, to move into a special life of a radical Christian commitment. Y'all come on in. When this life began, when they started living this kind of a life, it was still illegal to be Christian in the Roman Empire. And in some significant ways, many significant ways, this life of radical commitment was equated both by the people who took it up and by the admiring Christians who did not take it up, was equated with martyrdom. So that in the beginning of the first Christian, the first Greek life of the person who founded southern Egyptian monasticism, Pachomius, the very beginning, the very first paragraph, the lineage of the monastics is equated with the martyrs. They go to the monks, then the martyrs, and then back all the way through the prophets, back to Adam and Eve. Now these people, by the 4th century, monasticism of the Egyptian sort got a good start in the 3rd century, but it wasn't until after Constantine became emperor, and it was an easy thing then, relatively speaking, to get Christian, that monasticism really took hold. But it took hold very strongly in the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries. In Egypt and Palestine and Syria, and then finally in the West and in what we think of now as Italy. But Benedictine monasticism, which is what we are, most of us, familiar with, a version of Benedictine monasticism, that's the oldest Western form of monasticism. And that didn't really get started until the 5th century. Okay, now, one of the things you may hear me make a distinction between West and East, and you may be saying, what is that exactly? Usually when people speak of the Eastern Church, they're speaking of the churches in which Greek was spoken, and Syriac, some churches, Syriac, or Coptic, or Armenian. And the Western Church we associate with Latin, so that's, think of it in those terms. Now, one other interesting fact, while I'm tossing this in, is that the North African Church spoke Latin. So the North African Church went with the church in what we think of as Europe, though it had its own distinctive character. Augustine, or Augustine, as you may say, of course, was from North Africa, and was probably the most influential, he was the most influential theologian the Western Church ever knew. He was from North Africa. Okay, so we have these folks who have committed themselves to a radical Christian life in the Egyptian desert. as part of, these were the folks who founded, who were the founders of monasticism, but that early generations of monasticism was probably quite different from what we are accustomed to thinking of, which is we're more accustomed to thinking of organized medieval monasticism, and then the monasticism that has come down to us that we're familiar with in this century. But those first folks were pretty freewheeling. And it started by a single teacher would go out, or he wouldn't yet be a teacher, but someone would feel called to go out in the desert. Almost all these folks were men. I don't know, maybe more women were called to it than there were men, but women didn't get to do it in the desert. That women founded communities and towns and lived in all sorts of different monastic ways in towns, but they not too many women in the desert. Now, where was I? I got lost.
You said a single individual.
A single individual would go out into the desert and usually find another teacher and who was called the Abba, and say, can I live with you and learn your discipline? And the Abba would either let him or not let him. You know, and then they would live together, and he would train with that particular teacher in the ascetic life until he himself became a teacher, or maybe he will never become a teacher, just stay a disciple. Some of these communities would be two or three people. Some of them got to be a couple hundred people. I'm not sure whether in North of Egypt they got quite as big as that. I think they probably did. But each community would gain its character according to the disposition and character and intent of the Abba, the teacher associated, who was the head of that community. What they all had in common was, first of all, the goal of what they were about, which was love of God and love of neighbor. They were very clear that this is what Jesus commands in the Gospels, and that all Christians are called to this, to a radical love of God and love of neighbor. Now, they didn't think you couldn't do that in the world, but they were quite clear that it was a lot harder to do it in the world because there were too many temptations that you just didn't know what to do with. So most of them, all of them, lived celibately. Well, some of them may not have lived celibately, but they weren't supposed to live not celibately. But just for an example of the sort of thing they were trying to get away from, probably almost everybody in this room has had an experience where our jobs have put us in places where we had to decide between whether we were going to do what we were asked on the job that seriously compromised how we understood what our call as a Christian was. That we had to decide, are we going to go ahead and do that, or are we going to stay with our conscience? Now, that's an easy thing to decide maybe if you're a single person. But if you've got a family who's depending on you for food and a roof over their head and so forth, that's not an easy decision. That's the sort of thing they were avoiding. Now, that's one of the sorts of things. Another sort of thing they were avoiding in terms of their family ties was a much simpler situation that it looks like. It's much simpler now, but having grown up in my teenage years in the 50s, and there are other people here I see who are the same age as I or older, you know what I will be talking about too, where family expectations and family pressures were so great that they didn't even have to be anything like, you know, do I work for the atomic, for the factory that's making nuclear armaments? You know, it's more, can I pursue this career goal when my family will sees itself as being shamed by this? You know, well, they just said, we're just stepping right out of this. You know, how can you love when these are the controlling factors in your life? And so they just stepped right out of it. The same thing in terms of poverty. You know, they believed that as soon as you start owning things, that you get caught in a cycle of ownership where your energy is going into maintaining what you have, protecting what you have. You know, this is not even a part, not even raising the issue of always wanting more, but just where you're protecting, where all of your energy is going to protection, and fear is the dominant motive in your life. And they're trying to step right out of that and say, no, fear is not going to be what my life is about as a Christian. So they did not own property. They did not marry. They ate as vegetarians. Now, some of the southern ones, southern monastics, you know, the ones from Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama and Florida and Egypt, sometimes ate fish along with grains and vegetables. But the ones in the north didn't even eat fish. So what else do we need to know about who these folks were? Oh, one other thing that I'll say for the people who were not here yesterday is that these people, the Abbas and the Amas, the Amma is the female term describing the female teacher, and that means mother, or the Abba means father. These people were incredibly powerful people within their own culture. Now, when you just read the material about them and read what they say, you think these have got to be the most insignificant people in the world. You know, a bunch of cranks and went out into the desert, and how could they have any effect on anything? But in fact, they were convinced that if they lived out this radical vision of Christianity, that the world would be transformed. And they, in fact, had an enormous power and influence in their own time, and not just within the religious spheres, but also in the secular sphere. I mean, generals would go talk to them to ask advice, and the emperor would come out, you know, thinking of a 6th century situation where the emperor would ride out to visit Daniel Stylites on his horse outside of Constantinople to ask for advice. And one day, when he was returning, he had an accident on the horse, and he decided that the reason he had this accident was because he dared to ride in the presence of the holy man. And so from that time on, whenever the emperor visited Daniel, when he was within sight of Daniel's compound, he would go on foot. Now, the emperor was such a powerful person in the world. You know, he was the next person after Christ in the way society was structured, in the way the emperor was understood. He was such a significant person. So to say that the holy man took precedence over the emperor was really something. Okay, so does everybody feel caught up now? If you don't feel caught up, we'll see what we can do about
that. We're okay now.
You're okay? All right. Okay, so what I want to talk about today, then, is their understanding of love as the goal of the Christian life. Now, this sounds like a sort of uninteresting topic, since all of us learn from the time we were children that Jesus loves us. This we know, and the Bible tells us that. And that what we're supposed to do is love in return. The only thing is that they had some pretty radical ideas about this that I think can be really helpful to us. The starting point of their understanding of love was the fact that human beings are made to love. They were absolutely convinced that human beings are made to love. Now, what that works out to is that they would have said that love is natural, and not to love is not natural. Now, that in lots of ways really violates our common beliefs about what it means to be human. To say that to be human, that love is a significant and central part of being human because we're made that way, violates a lot of our common usage. For example, you know, if I'm sitting at the table having breakfast over here and I'm drinking my coffee, and you come up to me and you sit down and you start immediately asking me, what do I think about a significant and important and painful and difficult theological topic, say? And you talk and you're not going to let me just sit there and drink my coffee. And I finally snap and say, look, I just can't stand it. Just leave me alone and ask me later. See? And then you get your feelings hurt and you say, well, that's not very nice. Which would be a perfectly reasonable thing for you to say. And I say in return, well, I'm sorry, but you know, I'm only human. See, now we use that kind of language all the time, don't we? We just take that for granted, that when we're ugly, we're being human. We're not being ugly. We're somehow not being human. Now see, they would have that completely reversed. And they would say that what they might say to me is, well, they wouldn't say this because they wouldn't. It's not the sort of thing they'd say. But if they were to think it or say it, they would say, let's just be human beings about this. Now, that in itself is a pretty radical idea, that love is natural. Not to love is not natural. Now, of course, most of us don't experience that as natural a lot of the time, and that's because of the presence of all the things connected with sin that rise out of sin, which is a topic we're going to be talking about Friday, sin and the passions in here, that distort our vision of reality and distort our ways of seeing each other and ourselves and God. The work of God in Jesus Christ is to come and restore our abilities to love. That's one major element in the work of Christ, is to come and restore our abilities to love so that we could be human beings as God created us to be. Now, part of that, the work of Christ, in order to restore us to our abilities to love, is the defeat of death. I mentioned this yesterday, and I will say it again, that these early Christian teachers had no illusions about death as a natural part of life. They would say, well, yes, that's true. All mortal creatures die. But God did not intend that for us. Now, the way they work out of it from that point is to say that human beings live with the fear, continual fear of death and the loss that goes with it. Fear for our own death, but also fear of the death of the people around us. And that was a powerful part of the argument for the recruiting of people to the ascetic life, to the life in the desert. Gregory of Nyssa, a 4th century writer, who's actually from Cappadocia, which is in kind of the south middle part of what is now Turkey, wrote a little treatise called On Virginity. And he was a fairly young man. And he starts it off, he's exhorting young men to take up this life. And he starts by describing a marriage. And he describes this wonderful wedding, how the groom is just nuts about the bride. He just can't take his eyes off her. He's just so happy, he's ecstatic. And Gregory says, as soon as he gets married, what that man has to start doing is worrying about, is his wife going to die? And his wife doesn't die, he said, but then his wife gets pregnant. And then he's got to worry about what's going to happen to his wife in childbirth. And then supposing the wife doesn't die in childbirth and she brings forth a healthy baby, then he's got a wife and a baby to worry about dying. And then he assumes that the wife dies, and he describes the funeral and the grief of the husband and the wailing family, and he says, look, you don't want that. You know, you've been called to more than that. He says, marriage is a consolation for death, he says, by which he means having children is a consolation for death. Now, this is not necessarily a position that we want to embrace in the modern period. That we won't get married and have children because our spouses may die and our children may die. But I still think it's useful to think about the ways in which if we can bring our conscious mind, our fears govern our lives. That part is useful, I think, in this argument. Anyway, so we're digressing slightly, but not too terribly much. Okay, now Christians are called to perfect love. Now, perfect is a tough word for us. It's probably not as hard for Lutherans as it is for Methodists. Methodism was founded by an obsessive compulsive. He still has, he is a wonderful theologian, and he brings many wonderful gifts to our church, but he also makes many seminary students crazy. Because he was very regimented, and he'd get up every morning at 4 o'clock and read scripture in Greek and Hebrew, and then have his prayers for an hour, and you know, by 6 o'clock he'd be ready to start his enormous circuit riding and so forth. And Wesley spoke in terms of Christian perfection. So Methodist ministers, when they are ordained, still are asked as part of their ordination vows, are you going on to perfection? And the answer is supposed to be yes. This is not the right place to say, well, you know, I have trouble with that. But then, see, there's a worse question that follows that, and that is, do you expect to attain it in this? And the answer to that one is supposed to be yes. Now, I have to say that for Wesley was deeply influenced by the writings of the early church, and his understanding of Christian perfection is actually quite close to what theirs was. So that when the seminary students are, you know, get nuts over Wesley, they haven't quite gotten a hold of what he's doing. what the Abbas and Amas of the ancient world were about, and what John Wesley was also about. I'm not trying to convert anybody to Methodism. I'm just thinking about this. The goal was the transformation of the whole self into love, so that everything about you was loving. Heart, brain, the transformation of the whole self into love. And this was not understood as a process of, this was not a legalistic sort of notion, you know, where you could make up a list which you then checked off to see if you were in fact loving or not. And when you got it all, you said, oh, thank God I'm there. But it was understood as a process that went on throughout the whole of your life. Now Gregory of Nyssa, who was the one that I just mentioned who wrote the treatise on virginity, had another little treatise on Christian perfection. And he describes in that little treatise the process of the Christian life as growing always more into the love of God. And he says that this is not something that just goes on during this life, but that we are made in such a way that that process goes on for all eternity, that we grow and grow and grow. Yes?
Naive question.
Okay.
Some words are real stumbling blocks, like peace and love is another one. Uh-huh. What did these folks mean when they said in the fourth century, love?
Well, do you think you could wait just a little bit and we'll get to it? Mm-hmm.
I'm totally patient.
Oh, this is such a relief. Okay. Well, thank goodness I've got at least 15 minutes. Okay. I'm going to get to that. Partly I'm trying to get to that the long way around. That's what we're doing right now. Because we do have such odd notions about love. Now, the reason why I'm stressing the fact that love is the goal of the Christian life and that we move into love continually throughout eternity is partly because it is so counter to what our normal expectations are, at least in the South, where I come from. Now, Lutherans are an odd breed, and they may be different from other folks, and so what I'm about to say may not apply to you all, but this is a strong dynamic with us. And that is that whatever we say theologically, what we really believe is, from the day you become Christian, a Christian should love everybody. That's what we believe. You know, and so we sing songs like, well, you will know they are Christian by their love, you know. And we have little kids singing that. And we have people on summer camps singing that. And the assumption, we really work from the assumption that once you're Christian, you're supposed to love everybody. And you love God and you love your neighbor. And that's how you can tell if you're a Christian. Now, this is a completely different notion. This is a notion that assumes that loving is something we have to learn how to do. That while it is natural that we move toward love, that we have to learn how to do that. And partly we have to learn how to do that because of the effects of sin on our lives. Now, the fact that people believe that it's such a common notion in our churches that Christians love everybody from the first day they're Christian has two terrible effects, I think, on our churches. One of them is that half the people in our congregations feel shamed all the time because we know we don't love everybody. And so the question is, if we don't love everybody, are we Christian? So this is the whole massive shame culture in our churches. And another effect is when folks accuse us Christians of being hypocrites, it's because we say one thing, but we act differently because we don't have any way of talking about the way we act. See? So we're forced to re-describe our actions and say, you know, this is the I'm only hitting you because I love you. We lie to ourselves. We cover up what's really going on in our lives because we really believe that Christians are supposed to love everybody all the time. And so either what I'm doing is actually loving, it just doesn't look like that, you know, or I'm going to make sure you don't know what's really going on. Now, I'll tell you, a common sort of situation is folks going through marital problems in churches who will stop coming to church during that period when they're struggling, or who will come to church but make sure nobody knows about it. And that takes a great toll on everybody. It takes a toll on the couple who are struggling, but also takes a toll on everybody else too, because it's reinforcing this notion that, well, if you're a real Christian, you love everybody. You certainly love your spouse and you don't have troubles. Another common sort of situation is people who are having trouble with their teenagers. You know, whether it's drugs or alcohol or just general helling around or what, but who don't want anybody in church to know they're having trouble with their teenagers. Well, folks, it's hard to raise teenagers, you know, and it's hard to be married lots of times. And we have big problems in our lives learning how to love. And so, you know, if the goal of the Christian life is love, then church is where we ought to be training to do that. But how can we do that if we can't even talk about it? Because what we have to act like is, well, we already love everybody. We don't have any problems. See, so this one thing looks like such a simple little thing. Love is the goal of the Christian life. And yet it's so radical compared to what we're accustomed to. Now, one of the things it does is it removes that shame, that business. You know, so you're having a hard time with your spouse or your teenager or your neighbor or your person you work with at work. The proper response to that is not, oh no, I'm a terrible person, I'm a failure, or, you know, well, what can I do? I'm only human. But, well, I am a human being, and and what I should expect that I'm going to have to work at this. And this is not a sign that I'm a failure. This is good news, not bad news. You know, it leaves a space for grace and for us to confront honestly the things that cause us difficulty. You know, we don't have to be ashamed of the things that cause us difficulty. We'll say that's part of growing in love of God and neighbor and self too, for that matter. Now, has anybody got a question on that so far? I realize I have enough notes we could spend all week on each one of these topics, but don't worry, we won't. Okay, now, a couple of other comments before we get into discussion. I think I will answer the question, what are they talking about when they talk about love, before I talk about who are we supposed to love, in case we run out of time. We are accustomed also to think of love as an emotion. You know, you fall in love and then you get married, and when you fall out of love, then you get a divorce. You try to love your children, but you want to murder them a lot of time, and then you say, I must not really love my children. You know this pattern. We think of love as basically an emotion. The monastics thought of love as a disposition, that it was an attitude of heart that manifests itself in everything we do, in every way we are. And sometimes that disposition can run counter to our emotions. As, for example, I'd like to murder my children even though I love them. But to give an example, this is part of the difficulty with people with teenagers having babies. They have babies, and then the baby is so cute and sweet and wonderful. But the parents don't generally have the training and love to know how to deal with the baby. The baby is wonderful when it's cute and doesn't cry and sleeps nicely and everything. But then lots of babies are born very colicky, and all babies are born. So where if they survive and they get to about 2 years old, their favorite activities are things like putting scissors in the electrical outlets. that kind of stuff. And at that point, the parent has got to make a decision. You know, I'm worn out, I can't stand it, what am I going to do? A parent who loves the child is going to say, I'm worn out and I can't stand it, but I'm going to have to find a way to stand it. I'm going to have to do what I can do to help myself out. And if I can't help myself out, I still got to take care of this baby, because the baby can't take care of itself. Now, that's a decision of love, even though it doesn't feel like it. Now, read the paper every day, and there you will read about mothers who clearly couldn't stand it, and they locked their kids up in the house and went out and drinking in the bar, and something terrible happened to the children. There are mothers who make other decisions, and fathers who make other decisions, because they're confused over this issue. But love is a disposition, is a habit that governs all of our behavior. And basically, it also governs our feelings. Now, this is as it is, as we are moving toward it. This is not the starting point, but what we're aiming at. I remember when I was in seminary, it was quite common to say that emotion had nothing to do with love, that it was just a matter of making decisions and then living them out. The monastics would never agree with that, because they would say, we're all one, and the notion is to get our emotions lined up with everything else in us. So that if you characteristically can't stand the sight of your own child, and you find it hard to be civil to your child under any circumstance, year after year after year, then you might not say, I love my child. You might say, I love my child, but I can't stand my child. But then the question is, do I actually love my child? Because the emotions do matter. But in short-term situations, they may not have much to do with the disposition to love. Okay, questions at that point? Yes?
What's the relationship between this disposition to love and what comes naturally to us as humans?
Yeah. What comes naturally, we don't have control over. Our disposition, we choose. Now, here's a place to make another distinction, and that's between our disposition and our temperament. Okay, now, your temperament, you're born with. You know, you may be, energetic and outgoing and friendly. So that's your temperament you're born with. You don't choose to be like that. But your disposition is your temperament is obviously going to be an element in your long-term disposition. But disposition has to do with how you yourself are trained, both by yourself and by your community. So as churches, we ought to be in the business of training dispositions. Because your disposition, if it has to do with long-term ways, attitudes of heart and ways of relating to the world. For example, I'll just give an example. You can say, if you have a generally happy, easygoing temperament, and you are confronted by a situation of extreme poverty or need, or even, you know, your next door neighbor is really sick. Now, one way you can deal with that is, and maybe your most natural way to deal with that is to say, oh, I just can't deal with illness. And you just go on, you know. Believe me, I found out a little bit about this with my broken ankle. that I had one friend who did not call me one time in 4 months because she just cannot deal with any sort of illness, you know. Now, that's temperament. Now, for the development of your disposition, I got another friend who's got that same temperament who called up consistently and took me out someplace about once a week, even though this is my flute teacher. It was very difficult for him to deal with anything having to do with sickness. But he had made the decisions about what kind of person, what was important to him as a person. Now, the one is temperament, the other one is disposition. So they would say, none of us really ought to say, I just can't deal with those situations, such situation. That's our temperament if we say we can't. But we do have much more control of who we're going to be. They are assuming that we have control over who we're going to be. As Christian beings, as Christians, moving toward the goal of love, we make these decisions that train us in the habits of love and the ways of love so that it becomes easy to love. Is that clear? Does that make sense? Anthony, who I told you all about yesterday, if you were here, and if you weren't here, I'll tell you that Anthony is a person who is associated with being in people's minds as the first of the monastic teachers in Egypt. One of his sayings is preserved, and it goes something like that, like this. It says, no one picks up a bar of iron and puts it on an anvil and starts hammering on it and says, I wonder what I'm going to make of this, a sword or a plow. But you make up your mind in advance. And he says, in the same way with the virtues, we decide in advance what it is that we want to make, and we move toward that. Now, I think that's good. Pardon?
That's good.
Isn't that good? I just love that. Just love that. Yeah. So it's not just that we have love as a goal, but we also have to think about what does it take to reach that goal. you know, what are the things that get in the way of that goal, and what do we want to be trained to? Yes?
This is sort of following up on your question about what they meant by love, because I've been thinking a lot about Arsenius and Moses, and thinking with last evening he described one of the foremost of his fathers, that when somebody came out to see him and he said, I'll let you look at me if you promise to do what I ask, and he said, now what I ask you to do is never come back.
Never speak to me again as long as you live.
Clearly love is not just a matter of being nice.
It's definitely not just a matter of, because if that's what it took, Arsenius would not have passed the test.
And Lesrim's sort of interested in what the substance of this in terms of making these choices, but also clearly being able to say some sharp no's to demands.
Yes, that's really important.
And so I'd just be interested you to reflect on that a little more about, as they shape themselves to love, what are sort of the values or the substance of that love that they're envisioning, lest they be consumed.
Mm-hmm. And this is going to be different from person to person. One of the things that I was saying yesterday was that that how to reach that goal and what that goal looks like is not going to be the same for everybody.
So it's not one size fits all love.
It's not one size fits all love. Now, Arsenius was noted as a great prayer, so he may be telling Theophilus, the archbishop, I'm not going to spend time with you, but his life was about prayer, and this is prayer for the world. That was his work. Moses is who you just mentioned. His discipline was hospitality. And the goal is the same, but the route to it is different. Probably everybody in here struggled with this one in some form or another. I know that I certainly have. I've struggled with it in my professional life as a teacher in a seminary. When I started teaching at Candler 20 years ago, and started all of my teaching 30 years ago, or no, I'm afraid it was more than that. Yeah. There were very clear notions of what a teacher was to do, a certain kind of scholarly work and a certain kind of, you know, just very kind of pretty well laid out images of what that was supposed to be like. And that still followed me into my teaching at the seminary. The expectation was that I would write, continue to do the sort of work I'd done on my dissertation and in my early career, very highly technical writing on early texts and problems in early texts, and from a historical point of view that was meant to be understood as objective and rational and scientific and so forth. And at one point along the line started feeling great internal pressure that was not what I was supposed to be doing, that I was supposed to be doing a different kind of work than that. And it was a great struggle, internal struggle, to claim my own goals. And to say that, well, I really do think that as a seminary teacher, what I'm supposed to be doing is to help students and people in churches to understand the goal of the Christian life in terms of love, and then to draw on the resources that I think are there within our tradition to learn to get there. But to do that kind of work, I had to abandon this other understanding of what real scholarship was. Now, there are people on our faculty who are still doing that kind of scholarly work, whose understanding of the goal of the Christian life does express itself in those terms, and that's also appropriate. I mean, I work with the texts this way, but somebody's got to work on the texts, to preserve the texts, and to edit the texts, and so forth, and that's also appropriate. So finding what our own way is and what our own what the expression of that love is that's best for us is not always easy. Now, the other thing that you mentioned was, how do you keep yourself from being consumed by things that are that seem to be distracting? And that is a tough one, too. You know, in academic life, what that boils down to is committee work. but at home, it can boil down to a lot of other stuff having to do with people calling up. I mean, I've just learned things like, if somebody calls up and says, let's go have lunch, I'll say, well, no, I can't do that, but we can have coffee at 5 o'clock, you know, or 4 o'clock or something. To keep that goal, the goals that I have in mind all the time, so that all of the decisions that I make are made with that in view. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm just ruthless about my work, you know, because, again, the goal is love. And a year and a half ago, my best friend, Melissa Walker, who once came to Holden Village many years ago, was from whom I first heard about Holden Village. Melissa was diagnosed with 4-stage cancer. Now, that's quite serious. They told her right from the beginning that she had only a 15% chance of being alive in 5 years. So she started her treatments, you know, a year and a half ago, and I told her at the beginning, I thought about that really hard, prayed over it, didn't take too much praying over. And I told Melissa, now, you know, while you're going through this, this is my priority. You know, everything else takes second place to dealing with your cancer and getting you through this. And if you don't get through it, then I'll stick with you to the end. And we had a year where she was in treatment, terrible treatments for a year. And that was my priority for a year. And she's, her last treatment was, radiation treatment was in February, which was right before I broke my ankle. In fact, Melissa came to see me in the hospital, and her first words were, I'm lying there with my tongue hanging out and my eyes rolled up at the top of my head, and she said, well, I told you that someday I'd do the same for you, but I didn't mean right away. But, you know, I thought about that. Okay, here I write books about love. I think about love. I pray over love. I'm trying to grow into love. You know, how could I say to Melissa, you know, look, I can't do this, you know, because I got to write books about love. I couldn't do that. So it's not a matter of just saying, well, I'm not going to do anything, I'm just going to be single-minded toward the pursuit of this one goal. If the goal is love, then there are all sorts of other decisions that have to be made along the way. Melissa's doing pretty well, by the way. It's a matter of seeing what's going to happen. Her lungs got really badly damaged by the treatment, so she's had pneumonia 3 times since Christmas. I'm concerned about that, but she always is in good spirits. Okay, now, who do we love? So we're getting close on time here, but I want to have a couple things that I say before we quit. But if you want to interrupt me, that's just fine. I never mind being interrupted. There are lots of us who sympathize with character in the Brothers Karamazov, this character in Brothers Karamazov seems to have been the case that her ancestors almost all were living in a monastery in 6th century Gaza that was had as its abbot Dorotheus. Dorotheus is he's one of my favorites. He is probably my favorite teacher from the early church. Dorotheus is a boy's name, not a girl's name, by the way. It's Theodore spelled backwards. But Theodore was a very sweet person. And he, one time, he was trying to deal with the monks in his monastery who were all grumbling and saying things like, well, I could love God if I just didn't have to put up with these horrible people I have to live with. You know? And Dorotheus preached this wonderful sermon in which he told them, you know, how can you possibly say this? Or ask them, how can you say this? He said, you know, this is not possible. You can't say that I love God, but I don't love my neighbor, because the universe is not made that way. And he said, let me draw you a diagram. Presumably he got out his magic markers and his white board and everything. And he says, let me draw you a diagram. He says, imagine a circle. He says, now, and he mentioned drawing a circle with a compass. And of course, I'd forgotten that the Greeks invented compasses and was very surprised at this notion. But in fact, they had compasses. He says, imagine a circle. He says, at the point of the circle is God, at the very center of the circle. The outside of the circle, he said, is the circumference of the circle is the world. Human beings think of as lines that are drawn from the circumference to the center where God is. Those are human lives. Now, if you think about the world having many human lives, and what you get is a pie-shaped situation. Now, he says, imagine that you are moving from the circumference of the circle to God in the center. He says, if you notice, there is no conceivable way you can move toward God in the center without moving closer to the other human beings. That the closer you get to God, the closer the other you draw to other human lives. And conversely, he says, as you move away from other human lives, you have to also be moving away from God. Now, I just find this enormously helpful diagram of the way that Christians say love of God and love of neighbor are connected, that it is not in fact possible to love God without loving the neighbor. And it's not possible to not love the neighbor and still love God. Now, the goal was to love all human beings with whom we come in contact. Though, remember that loving does not necessarily mean, liking, enjoying the company of, necessarily. Though, I don't know, I think it has more to do with liking than I used to. I find it, I don't know about you all, the older I get, the more I find it possible to like more and more people. So anyway, love of God and love of neighbor are connected like that. Now, the last thing I want to say is talk about is the love of God. Just a couple things about that. That is that just as we Christian folk of the 20th century Protestant persuasion in America tend to think that that we should love God from the first day we become Christians, and we should love human beings. We should also love God. Now, again, this is a great theory that we should love God from the beginning. But the fact is, the monastic teachers warn us that all of us live so subject to the effects of sin and what they call the passions, which we'll be talking about Thursday, that we can't even see God. You know, our vision is so distorted by our own experience that what we have to learn as part of the Christian life is who God really is so that we can love God. Now, a common experience that I have as a teacher is to have students come in. Usually this has to do with the identification of God as Father, but if we talk much about God as Mother, then we have problems with students on that side. But who will come in and who are accustomed to hear the language of God as Father all the time. But they have had some horrendous difficulty with their father. And I had some of this trouble myself because I had a very authoritarian and in some ways very arbitrary father. And it was impossible for me for most of my years until in my 40s to think of God the Father in terms other than that God was arbitrary and unpredictable. I could easily make God angry, you know, and I never knew how God was going to respond. And I'm trying to love this God, see, and yet this is a God who doesn't care whether God hurts me or not, but it's sort of the I'm only hitting you because I love you sort of approach to things. Now, the way human beings are made, we learn our first images of God from our relationships to our parents and the significant folk in our lives as we're children. We're just made like that, you know. And part of the job as adults is to sort out the difference between who God is and who our parents are. Now, as I said, lots of people have problems with God the Father because we use that father language. But I've also had students who had terrible problems with their mother and had that, you know, that their images of God were associated with who their mother was. And they needed to sort that out. Sometimes this is obvious, you know. Sometimes it's not so obvious. I had a friend who was a Dominican sister. She was trying to decide whether to leave her order or not. And she was struggling a whole lot with this because she loved her fellow sisters. She loved the people that she was also, that she was in community with, and she'd been in community for a long time. But she also felt like she really wanted to get married. Now, she wasn't leaving for a particular man, but she just decided that she wanted a different kind of life. She was called to a different kind of life. But it was very painful to her because her life as a Dominican had been really a happy one. It was not a negative thing. And she came and she was talking to me one day, and I said, well, have you prayed about this? You know, she's talking about her mental anguish. And I don't know why these words came out of my mouth. You wouldn't think that those words, you'd need to say that to a person whose whole life was really about prayer, as hers was. And it just completely stopped her, you know. She just stopped dead. And then she said, well, no, I guess I haven't. And I thought about this, and for some reason it came to me, and I said, tell me again how many kids there were in your family. And she said, 9. And I said, where did you come down in the order of children? She says, well, I was the 5th. And I said, what used to happen when you got sick, or any of the children got sick when you were in school? How did your mother deal with that? And she says, oh, my mother was a wonderful mother as long as everything was going well. But when one of us got sick, it was just pushed her over the edge. It was just more than she could handle. And we just learned that we were supposed to just keep this to ourselves as best as we could and not bother mom with it. Well, I said, now, do you think there could be any connection between your inability to pray over this and the way you related to your mother? And she said, oh, yeah, I had never thought of that. Of course. I said, I don't want to bother God. You know, God's got so much to handle already, you know, the whole universe. But the ways in which those primary relationships when we're growing up affect our ways of relating to God are really interesting and important. And part of the growth and love of God is to sort those things out, so that we can actually relate to who God is rather than a sort of larger version of our parent written into sort of, you know, cosmic terms. Okay, I think that's...
Did she leave?
She did leave, and in fact, she got married about... I think it was October. She met a very nice man, and we're hoping that she will live happily ever after. But it was a very hard decision for her. Questions? That's all I'm going to... Yes?
Your goal is love. Do you monitor yourself along the way?
You have to monitor yourself.
How do you keep track?
Well, you can monitor yourself for unloving behavior and feelings and attitudes. I mean, just by paying attention, I think. And it gets easier, I think. I mean, I think we probably all do this. But we can be maybe more attentive. So that when we say something hateful, we immediately hear ourselves say it. It doesn't just sort of go out of our mouths and we say, well, you know, I'm only human, what could I do? You know, but that we decide in advance, I don't want to do that. It's the same as living in a marriage, I think, that you can decide when you're first married, maybe, I don't know whether you can decide it later or not, seems like you ought to be able to, that when we fight, no matter what happens, we will not say things that are deliberately hurtful to each other. I mean, you can make that decision and then monitor it, but then you have to monitor that all the time. You know, that's just an example of that. A parent can decide, there are certain things I will never say to my child, you know.
Yes. In connection with that, what would you say about this Lutheran theme that we often talk about, simultaneous et peccator, simultaneously saint and sinner? I mean, for Lutherans often, I think that's kind of an escape valve.
Yeah.
We're afraid of measuring perfection or attempting to, or progress or monitoring, all that kind of thing.
And that was, I think, part of the original intent of that simultaneously saved and a sinner. It was a sort of warning against self-righteousness. Never say, you know, we can never say to ourselves, well, I'm already what I need to be. Too bad you're not. You know, now, they were very concerned about self-righteousness in the ancient desert. Really, really concerned about that. But it wasn't how God sees us that they were concerned about, but they were concerned about the effect of self-righteousness on the people around us. You know, the harm we can do to others by our self-righteousness. So we know that we're sinners, but we can still say that what we're moving toward is the removal of those things that get in the way of love as much as we can. We know that that is something that is a work of God's grace more than it's of our effort, but we have to put our effort into it, our full effort into it. But we don't have to worry when we find ourselves committing an atrocity, which we all find that we do at one point or another. We don't have to, that frees us from saying, oh my gosh, it's all or nothing. You know, we can say, because love is a goal, you know, my salvation doesn't depend on me getting it right in this moment. See, this is another way of talking about that Lutheran principle, really. It sounds like it's not, but it in fact is. It means I don't ever have to say, well, it's over. I had a grandmother who was manic depressive, and in her later years, when she was manic, she was really manic. And I remember hearing one of my aunts say, my grandmother was also Southern Baptist, I hope that when she dies, she's not in her manic. They didn't recognize it as a mental illness. They spoke of her being on her high horse. And he says, oh, I hope she's not on her high horse. When she dies, she'll go to hell for sure. it's either one or the other, you know. And this is a different sort of approach to that. This would say, well, no, that's not really the issue. Yes?
We were talking about which comes first, our emotions or our behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times our emotions, our liking, our fondness, our warm feelings are going to be how we relate to people. I think it works just as well the other way around. And I've been, you know, through my family, predisposed to be averse to certain collections or groups of people. But I find that when I intentionally put myself there, that when you get to know people, almost invariably you get to like them.
I know. This is really right.
Yeah, you're out of the 50s. You remember that song by the Teddy Bears, you know, to know him is to love him. And I think it's theological also.
Well, folks, we've gone over our time a little bit, so anybody wants to get up and leave, this is just fine. In fact, we should probably quit. But I will see whoever wants to be here tomorrow.
Okay.